Hey, what's up, folks? It's Space Cafe podcast time, and I am Marcus. So I came across an interesting thought recently. Someone said that if we really wanted to go to Mars, we could do it tomorrow. From a technical perspective, we're ready. Almost. But something else, something profound stands in our way. Our own anxiety to fail. We've become a risk-averse society with zero tolerance for failure, not to mention human casualties. An interesting thought, I must say. I mean, no president or decision-maker, no NASA or ESA would survive a complete loss of a human Mars mission unharmed. And of course, there is a name behind this provocative claim that we could go to Mars tomorrow. And this name has quite a track record in the space industry.
Oh, that's way in my... If you can hear that, that's awesome. That's like at my front door through several doors.
Our guest today is an American space scientist and aerospace engineer. He previously worked as a spacecraft navigator at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he was a navigator for a bunch of Mars missions. He is currently an associate professor of aerospace engineering and engineering mechanics at the University of Texas at Austin.
I think I'm a tough professor when it comes to using common sense and that sort of stuff.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Moriba Jha. By the way, if you have the possibility to hit pause and stop for a second, I urge you to do so now, because it's essential that you look this guy up on your favorite search engine, Moribajah. And if you think you might have picked the wrong one, you have found him.
I would say that I definitely don't seem like the quintessential engineer or astrodynamicist. And I think that I've always kind of stuck out a bit, but certainly as I've gotten older, I've allowed myself to just come out of my shell. And, you know, in the beginning of my career, it was, I was just very intimidated, and many people told me in no uncertain terms that I had to look a certain way and that sort of thing. Mm. And so I did those things. But then, you know, as I developed in my own profession, and people started knowing me more for the work that I did, I just let myself kind of be whoever I am. But I do have to say that I've gotten no shortage of comments over the years. Like, people have directly told me, there's no way that looking like you do that you'll ever amount to anything, and these sorts of things.
I'm glad they're mistaken.
Indeed, my brother.
I have the impression when we talk about appearances that you're doing the entire science community a big favor by portraying the not cliche scientist. What would you say?
Yeah, so here's an even better way to say it, man. I firmly believe that there's a scientist that lives inside of everybody. And to me, I take science in the literal sense, which is, the Latin word for knowledge. And each of us has an understanding, just an inherent understanding of how some things work in the universe and in life and these sorts of things. And all of us, this knowledge that we acquire, you can call it intuition or any other things, right? It's, it's science. But I just think that the traditional concepts that people have of science are very constrained to classroom settings and textbooks with lots of equations and these sorts of things. Mm. And I think it's my purpose. One of my inner duties is to break down these walls and demystify this stuff, because I want to make sure that people know that there's a scientist inside of everybody, and knowledge is something that should be pervasively accessible.
Try talking to your president about that.
For whatever reason, they don't answer my emails and phone calls. So.
keep trying, please.
Yeah, yeah, right. I keep getting a busy signal, right.
So what drives this guy? Many things, as we'll discover over the next 45 minutes. But most and foremost, a change of mind when it comes to space travel.
We have to understand how to explore other places. But in doing so, it shouldn't be that we just do what's legal. We need to do what's right. And so where I'm getting with all this is that I look at specific populations of our planet, indigenous people specifically, like the Inuit in the Arctic, like the Aborigines in Australia, the Maori in New Zealand, the Navajo. And there are pockets of indigenous people that for thousands and even tens of thousands of years have understood what it means to be in balance with their environment, and that they don't believe in ownership of land and these things. It's more of custodianship and stewardship. And these principles of ecological knowledge, I think those need to be the basis of exploration so that we don't colonize, you know, whatever the hell that is. Like, we shouldn't even be using those words. Or we're gonna colonize, and we're gonna just take over, and we're gonna
right.
It's like the same stuff over and over again, and it can't be that way.
I mean, if you're following along the ideas of Elon by saying that we are destined to become, destined is the wrong term, we should become a interplanetary species, that would mean that we weren't able to take care of our shit back home, so we need to find another place and take our issues and everything that comes along with that to different places. So the question is that the right move to become an interplanetary species, or would it be the proper move to take care of our home?
These things overlap. I don't see them as mutually exclusive. We have to do both. I guess what I'm saying is that even if, let's assume that everybody on the planet, we stop eating red meat, we grow these things, you know, cell-based meat, we move to plant-based type meat like exists now, which is pretty good. I love these burgers that are made from plant-based stuff now. They actually taste like meat, you know. If we did all of these things, we are still growing. And and even though it extends, basically what I think living in an ecologically sustainable way on Earth, I think it extends our expiration date, but it doesn't eliminate it. And so the thing is, we need to also look at how does humanity make its way to other celestial bodies to continue in this experiment. The thing that really kind of freaks me out is that when I look at how people behave, look, just between skin color and these sorts of things, we already treat ourselves differently. If you have humans evolving on, say, Mars that doesn't have a global magnetic field, it doesn't have a big moon that orbits 28 days, you know, that regulates cycles of women and all these other things, the people that are born and are raised there are going to look different, very different than humans. And the thing is that if we're so prejudiced against ourselves on the same planet, imagine what the Martian human might look like and how we're going to start wars with, you know. It's like, that's the thing that I'm trying to prevent. It's like, we need to do this exploration. At the same time, there's some behaviors that are unnecessary that we can eliminate in order to extend that expiration date.
Going back to Elon Musk, he's pushing the boundaries. He announced his plan to take, a million, or is it a billion people to Mars? So how serious are you taking those visions?
Not at all, really. I mean, I think, here's the deal. The thing that I like about Elon is he puts these numbers, and I don't take these as being things that are like written in stone or cast. If I read in between the lines, it seems like he is very interested in inspiring and basically trying to expand the mindset of people. Like if people can accept, oh yeah, a million people, okay, and work towards that, maybe that never actually happens in that way, but at least you're working towards it, and maybe maybe it's 100 or whatever. But
I have an omega point to work towards.
Yeah, and so I think that what Elon tries to do is he tries to say, listen, in order for there to be a journey, you have to have a destination, and I'm just going to make a destination up just so that we can start moving.
Absolutely.
And we won't necessarily get to that destination. We'll get to a destination, but at least there's movement. He seems to be a very dynamic person. He's not about stagnation. And so I think a lot of the stuff that he says, I just take it at face value. And I'm like, he just doesn't want to be stagnant. And so he's just spewing stuff. But the thing that really upsets me, man, is that humans always want a messiah. Mm-hmm. Humans are always... they're always seeking, who's the person who I can put all of my faith into? And that way I can absolve myself of responsibility. If it doesn't turn out right, we know who to crucify.
He's to blame, yeah.
Big time. And the thing is, it's just a very unfortunate thing that we do as people is this idolatry and this messianic blah, blah, blah. Look, Elon's just another dude. He's a dude that has a big vision. You know, bravo. There are things that he does that I think is complete crap. Like I don't subscribe to it, right? But in general, I think he's been a positive aspect of humanity. And I just feel it's very sad to me that he has groupies and people that are just blind, you know, they're just fanatics. I think fanaticism in and of itself is just, it's a horrible thing.
I think I need to set this straight. Moriba has all the right to make those claims because he started his career where others would be happy to end theirs.
NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, I mean, like, this is usually something that is the epitome of where space people want to be at, right?
Yeah, and so I think one of the interesting things, Marcus, about my career is that, you know, some people might say, oh, well, this guy started at the mountaintop, and then it's been downhill ever since. When I was right outside of high school, I enlisted in the Air Force, and my job was to be a security guard. I guarded nuclear missiles in Montana, and the thing that kind of made me focus on space, aside from the missiles and that sort of stuff, was that during my night shifts, I'd see dots of light going across the sky that weren't planes, they weren't meteors. And when I did some research, I came to find out that these things are human, you know, anthropogenic, human-made objects in Earth orbit. Mm-hmm. And that just fascinated me that I could, with my naked eye, I could see sunlight reflecting off of things that humans put in space. And I'm like, I have to do that. Like, that's a thing that I have to get involved in.
Wow. So before we get into those Mars missions and leave the planet now in a couple of seconds, tell me honestly, how many doors personally and professionally did that jet propulsion thing open for you?
I think it's the basis of all the success in my career.
Wow. I envy you. Okay, take it as it is.
Oh, please.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your Mars explorations. What was the most memorable moment you would like to share with us?
So there are a couple of moments. I can tell you that one of the scariest moments that I had, this was during Mars Odyssey.
A quick side note, 2001 Mars Odyssey is a robotic spacecraft orbiting the planet Mars. The project was developed by NASA and contracted out to Lockheed Martin with an expected cost for the entire mission of $279 million.
And I was, spacecraft navigator. I was trying to go to school in Boulder, finish up coursework for my PhD, and still work full-time at JPL. Lockheed Martin, they were a partner in this because they built the spacecraft and they had their own operations center from Denver, Colorado. And so basically I volunteered. Part of me getting onto Mars Odyssey, you know, Bob Mace was the navigation chief and all that, mission manager. And I said, listen, give me the job. I'm going to work nights, weekends, and holidays, right? And I want to be able to go to school in Boulder. And so they said, okay, we're going to send you out to Denver, to Lockheed, to be a spacecraft navigator, like doing it remotely from Lockheed. And we'll see how that goes. And so that sounded great. And so on one of these, you know, part of what Mars Odyssey did is it did this thing called aerobraking. And so aerobraking is this technique that lets you save lots of fuel by dipping into the atmosphere and letting the atmosphere slow you down and remove energy from the orbit. Instead of having to use your thrusters and all this fuel, mm-hmm. you can let Mother Nature kind of do that naturally. But the thing is that it can be a very very dangerous and contentious aspect of the mission, because as the thing's going through the atmosphere, you lose communication with the satellite. Before it goes in the atmosphere, it sends some signals, radio signals. It turns away from the Earth, goes through the atmosphere. At some point, it comes back out and reorients itself.
It doesn't.
Right? You're praying to get the signal back. And then the thing is, then you have to decide, did it go too deep in the atmosphere and I have to do a maneuver to bring it back out? Or did it not go deep enough because there's a certain timeline that I have to follow? So I need to do. So you have to make decisions about when to do maneuvers and sequences. And so as a navigator, you have to take some data before it goes in the atmosphere and some data afterwards and figure out what happened in between and quickly relay that information to people to make these decisions. Wow. And I remember on one of these, I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, and we still haven't heard back from the spacecraft. And we're getting close to the time when I have to deliver, you know, this updated trajectory to the rest of the people on the mission. And people are calling me on the phone. What's going on? When will you have an orbit ready? I'm like, I still have no data from this thing. And the thing is, man, is finally I got a few measurements, Doppler and range measurements, and people are going to freak out when they hear this. But it was like, I had so few measurements that the trajectory, if I just took one measurement out, it would be like a whole different orbit. Like, it was just not enough information. And so I just had to make a call as to what I believe the best orbit was. And I did that. And that's what I sent. And thankfully everything worked out, but it was like one of those things where I felt very responsible and I'm like, wow, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm here by myself. People are counting on me to come through. And I just need to make my best professional decision about this.
Hold on. It's in the morning. There's a $300 million mission. And there's one person and one joystick in my layperson's imaginary world, sitting at a table doing his thing, potentially risking the entire $300 million mission. Is that a way to describe it?
That is a way to describe it, yes.
All right, so a lot could have gone wrong here, and a bunch of phone calls were ready to be placed.
Absolutely, man.
Great story. Thank you for that. So when do you think the first boot will be placed on Mars? Human boot.
Here's my honest answer. If we wanted to do this now, we could do it.
Technically?
Yeah. I think technically we could do this very quickly. Here's the issue, Marcus. When humans were explorers centuries ago and that sort of stuff, there was a certain level of risk people were willing to take. Explorers were willing to
risk their lives.
Right? They're like, risk their lives to in the name of exploration. People did that. And many people died in that process. And people learned through that. We as a society have become completely, completely intolerant to the idea of the loss of life. And because of this, it's going to take a long time before we get people to Mars. Right now, if you told people, NASA, whatever, listen, we're going to send you to Mars. Chances are it's not going to work out for you. Do you still want to go? There is no shortage of people that are going to say yes. But we as a society will not, you know, when people die in this process, it'll be like a stain, right? Taxpayers are going to be like, let's defund mm-hmm. NASA because they lost astronaut lives mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. People, for whatever reason, have become accustomed to it has to succeed with 100% probability, and that makes price go up. It extends the time before you actually. So to me, it's like it's not even part of exploration. Like these things are inconsistent. Completely risk averse and exploration. Those things cannot live in the same space. And we can take smart risks, but we've got to take risks, and people have to realize, you know what? Chances are people are going to die in this process of space exploration, sending people out to Mars. Like that's probably going to happen. And we should be prepared for that. But you know, that is like political death. Anybody who runs on a platform mm-hmm. on space exploration, hey, put me in office. Like talk about if there's a US president that all of a sudden pushes for we're going to the moon in 2024. Let me tell you something. I mean, I can't speak for what's in the current president's mind, but I can tell you that that's a politically bad thing to happen. If during mm-hmm. the next Artemis stuff, people actually, there's a loss of life in that process, that's a huge stain. And so, that's my view about Mars, man. We could get there. Let's launch somebody next week, right? But it's going to be very risky, and it's probably not going to turn out so well. But people are very risk averse these days, and I think that has been to the detriment of exploration.
That's a very, very interesting and profound idea. And I think at the same time, a profound issue, because we're not going to get rid of that, because this is engraved in our social self-understanding. And so I do not really know who might be able to take that away from us, because this is how we think, how we believe, what we believe. Is it some kind of ethics? Is it moral? I don't know what it is. So I don't know. But that keeps holding us back. So I think NASA in itself experienced that over the past couple of years, I would say that. I mean, like NASA was never super open to risking it all. I mean, like they were trying to make sure that everything needs to be safe. And Elon is doing his thing and blowing up things, and he's a different kind of person. And I think this is perhaps it's different approaches towards society, what we're seeing here in NASA and in Elon. Would that make sense?
Elon probably, I would assume, is probably government process. I think he's very happy with the Dragons now, you know, the first commercial, yada, yada, yada. But I'm sure it was quite painful for him because NASA did not loosen the requirements of safety for Elon. And so right. Elon had to fit in through the NASA hole.
So he had to hold back.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm sure that frustrated him. But look, I mean, we have a successful mission. Both astronauts, that are the space dads, went there, came back successfully. So there's something to be said about that as well.
But perhaps it won't come to that because we won't make it into orbit or beyond. Yes, we're talking about space junk, aka space debris. As we mentioned earlier, we're really good at messing things up. Down here on Earth, on the moon, and of course in space. To boldly leave our footprint wherever we go, or so they say. Sometimes it feels like we're behaving like dogs who need to pee against every corner they encounter to make sure they remember they own the place. Okay, perhaps that was a little bit far-fetched, but really, space debris is a massive and imminent danger to all of our future space endeavors. So naturally, Moriba decided to do something about it in a rather provocative manner. How many pieces are up there at the moment?
Yeah, so things that we can track or that we're kind of aware of, probably around 26,000 or so, total objects, working and non-working anthropogenic space objects. But out of the working stuff is probably like 3,000, and everything else is is, you know, dead stuff. And yeah, so that's, and that's what we can track, but we hypothesize that things that could actually do quite a bit of damage, things that go all the way down to, you know, the, you know, millimeter size, you know, speck of paint traveling at high speeds. We believe those numbers are more like in the, you know, half a million things.
A million.
Yeah. Half a million.
Half a million. Okay. Yeah. Wow.
So I know you're all shaking your heads now. How can we not take care of our remnants in space? Can't we take it back home or at least dump it in an official space dumpster? I am with you, my friends, but you know what? Wherever I go running, I see piles of trash along the roads, even in the deepest forests. Because, hey, what else would you do with your leftovers from your favorite drive-through calorie service? Open window, bag out, close window, memory gone, right? We're just a pathetic species, aren't we? Hey, am I in a bad mood today? Anyways, the only problem with this analogy is that our little space trash is extremely dangerous because it does not stop doing crazy things once left to itself.
And I like the fact that you know, ended with saying that it's moving, because it's like, imagine people throwing it out their window and the thing doesn't stop. It just keeps on going. And so all the trash is moving with the things that are not trash. And there are no space cleaners per se. I mean, there are a couple of companies like Astroscale, and ESA has the clear space mission that they're going to launch in 2025, but nobody's really getting paid to be the sweepers of space yet. And most of the stuff in these orbital highways, there's no off ramp. They don't leave and they don't come back. And so that's part of the issue, is that when things die, the better analogy is like ships at sea. It's like a boat. It runs out of fuel. The boat doesn't necessarily stop. It keeps on going with whatever the currents are. And so the debris and all that is going with whatever the space environment currents are. And it's very difficult to predict all this garbage and how it's moving. And yeah, for the things that we can't track, you just hope that you don't get hit by one of these things, you know, wrong place, wrong time sort of thing.
So how much time do we have? How much space travel time do we still have?
If we don't do anything about it, to me, it's inevitable that we will experience a so-called tragedy of the commons, in which space will become unusable to provide the services and capabilities that we depend on every day, like position, navigation, and timing, banking, like all these things, right? That will happen if we don't do anything differently. And right now, the biggest contributor to the growth of trash are people that are non-compliant with agreed-upon guidelines, not laws, guidelines on how to mitigate debris. So there are people all over the world in governments. The IADC put out some debris mitigation guidelines. United Nations Committee on Peaceful Use of Outer Space has a long-term sustainability guidelines, 21 of them that they adopted by consensus over 90 countries like last year. And these are suggestions, recommendations, high recommendations of, listen, if we want to have an environment that's long-term sustainable, if you behave and do these things, it'll be extremely helpful. And that'll actually, you know, flatten the curve. But there's a high degree of non-compliance. And how do you incentivize the compliance if it's not, again, legally binding stuff? And my answer to that is the work that I've been doing with this Astrograph thing, which is try to crowdsource information about stuff in space, monitor for the compliance, put it on a public website, and let the naming and shaming begin.
Mm. So did you get any reactions? Like, did Putin call you, or Trump, or NASA?
So none of the first two have called me. I can say that a number of agencies, NASA, that sort of stuff, they do bring me in as, you know, a technical expert to provide consultancy on a number of issues. You know, they are all aware of the work. The U.S. government, in great part, has funded this Astrograph thing that I've been doing. So people are aware of it. I think, in general, Many people think it's a good idea. Some people don't like the idea of having a transparent space because they want to be able to hide and get away with stuff. So, yeah.
Okay. So some people might say, who cares about space? I live on Earth. I don't give a shit about space and what's going on out there. But you, I think, have a bunch of interesting answers, because if our satellites do not work anymore, a bunch of things on Earth do not work anymore. So what could be the biggest issues if we lose our satellites?
So I'll say it this way, Marcus. I remember having a conversation with former Vice President Al Gore just over a year ago about this issue. And he's very much focused on climate change, right? It was evident that there wasn't a whole lot of bandwidth in his project to look at space debris. But what I said is the following. Space is geopolitically contested. Countries are vying for this kind of, high ground. In fact, it's the motto of the Space Force, right? Semper, supra, always above. Space is commercially contested. Elon, Bezos, other people trying to vie for where to place the satellites as quickly as possible to deliver their service and get paid for it. But space needs to be environmentally protected for the reasons that I spoke about, these orbital lanes and things not coming back. And look, services like position, navigation, and timing. I can't tell you when the last time I actually used one of these fold-out maps. It's been a really long time. And I have to tell you, my experiences with fold-out maps was very frustrating, especially in cities. I had to stop and ask for directions all the time. I'd get lost big time. Mm-hmm. We have automated so many things based on position, navigation, and timing services from global navigation satellite systems. If those disappeared, we'd be set back 100 years in terms of how to navigate stuff. You know, maybe people in the Navy know how to use a sextant and these sorts of things, but this generation of people would be, if I give one of my kids a map and say, find your way from A to B, they'd have no clue, man. None. Mm-hmm. And so we have a generation of young people who have no idea how to get around without these kind of services. And again, we've automated air traffic and a lot of stuff. So, transportation writ large would come to a grinding halt in the absence of this. The other thing, too, is that people don't realize the timing part of the PNT. You know, financial transactions are stamped with space-based timing services. So, you want to know when you're making a deal or trading a stock, or you want to go to the ATM and pull out money. Sorry, but there are satellites that now all of these capabilities get routed or provided by these. And so that gets, world economy comes to a stop in the absence of satellites. So these are the things that I think people just don't quite realize, that more and more of our services and capabilities are space-based. I even spoke to a company this morning, banking information in terms of specific keys for authentication to know the identity of people, like that blockchain kind of stuff, that is even being put on satellites as a way to remove dependency from the ground. So it's a scary world, man, where more and more of the technology is space-based, and yet, we don't have any traffic rules established.
So who's listening to you?
That is a very good question. Within the space community, I'm very well known, but the space community is a community that suffers from a lot of elitism, a lot of isolationism. We idolize astronauts and glorify these folks, and billionaires. And we have groupies, and we kind of tell people that they're not smart enough to get it. We speak pejoratively to people who aren't involved in space. So I think we're part of our own problem when it comes to that. The biggest evidence for me to start seeking a public voice outside of the self-licking ice cream cone of space people was my TED Talk. And when I became a TED Fellow and gave my 5-minute talk in Vancouver, look, I already have more than 1.7 million views of that five-minute talk. man, I haven't interacted with 1.7 million people within the space community in my 20 years in doing this stuff, you know? And so I think that we need to if we really want people to understand and support this, we need to normalize space, let people know that space is just another domain of human activity. It shouldn't be treated differently than oceans, the air, the land. Space is just the next place where people just do stuff. And we should normalize it and make it seem like, yeah, this is something that is for everybody and you should care about it.
I see two things that need to be done. So one thing is, of course, to make sure that there are policies in place for future missions so that whoever launches a satellite or a rocket into space is asked to take care of whatever debris this produces. So it should be a mission that leaves nothing behind in the first place. But then, of course, we need to take a look at our past and take care of our 500,000 pieces that are still floating up there. So do you see any technological solutions on the horizon, how we could get rid of those? Or will they sort of get rid of themselves anyways, but it just takes time?
Thing number, and some of my answer, neither you nor listeners are going to want to hear. The first thing that I'm going to say is that we need to know how to live in our own filth. And what I mean by that is that we will never be able to clean the current debris population. That will never happen. So we have to say, you know what? We have to be comfortable operating in space with the current level of filth that exists on orbit. And what we need to do is we can clean a few things that could become a big problem, like the big rocket bodies, these sorts of things, right? We know that big objects, when they explode or collide, become many, many smaller ones. So we need to eliminate those. But incentivizing compliance on the front end, like you said, to flatten that curve out, the World Economic Forum is working on something called the Space Sustainability Rating, which would be something like a rating that you would get like restaurants and hotels, something that incentivizes behaviors that would flatten out that curve. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you this, man, just like people on Earth that are ecologically sound are trying to minimize and eliminate single-use plastics, I would have a strong movement to try to eliminate single-use satellites. Mm. It's like, if you're going to put a satellite up there, if it's going to be single-use, you should be penalized for that.
Right.
You should have a plan to dispose of it as soon as possible. Otherwise, design the satellite so it can be multi-use. Design the satellite so it can be recycled on orbit, can be repurposed, can be. So these are things that I would start really trying to push for. And the only way to legislate this stuff is if it can be measured and verified after the fact. So this is where my work comes in, is like, you can't enforce something you don't know, and you don't know stuff that you don't mm-hmm. measure. It's all about measurements.
Mm-hmm. So what's on your plate for the next couple of years? What are you trying to achieve in the next couple of years?
I think that we have to force discussions to be more inclusive. If the decision makers are not diverse, then it's not inclusive. And so the thing is, nobody has gone to any of these indigenous people or people living in rural areas and saying, hey, you know what? I'm going to give you global internet, but whenever you look up at the sky, you're going to see all sorts of stuff. And I'm not even going to ask you how you feel about that. Like, that's right. Crap, man. You know, and so the thing is, am I saying that part of the legal process of licensing satellites means that you have to go and have a conversation with Native Americans, blah, blah? Maybe I'm not saying that that is the legal recourse, that has to be made into law. But we should all be extremely motivated to make sure that the decision making regarding our activities and how we proceed in exploration is set within diversity, that the influence, that the decisions come from a diverse pool, and not just, you know, telling people in a room that are diverse, this is what we're doing, you know.
Mariba, I'm applauding you with multiple hands filling the entire room I'm sitting alone in. So thank you for that. So we're almost at the end of our beautiful conversation here. I hope you don't mind, I'm totally taking advantage of you being a space debris expert. And so I'm saying this because the other day I heard a pretty interesting theory, and this points a little bit into the science fiction world, why traveling at warp drive is completely bullshit, not only because of Einstein, but also because of space debris. Because those guys said, and I find this very, very compelling, there's no pocket in space without a grain of dust. And when you're traveling at warp drive, you will never find a highway that is so void of any grains of dust that would make a safe travel possible. Because at warp drive, this grain of dust would, of course, produce an energy of an atomic bomb, so to say. Does that make any sense to you as a space debris expert?
So here's what I'm saying. I think that we should build all of these warp drive spacecraft out of this unique material that's called unobtainium. And if you just build it out of unobtainium, then it'll all work out, man.
Good, good. Thank you. Thank you. A beautiful way to end this. Moriba, there's one last question. We do have a very nice tradition at the end of our show. This is a Space Cafe podcast. I hope you like coffee.
Yeah.
Good. And so let's have a shot of coffee right now, the Space Espresso, because it's a quick shot of a story. Tell me one of your favorite science stories or space stories, which are, without much thinking, that come up to your mind right now. So what would you like to share with us?
So I think, one of my favorite stories is I was approached one day at JPL by my boss, and he said, you know, I have something to offer to you. You can work on this Mars mission, but you won't get in the news. Nobody will know that you worked on it. But you know, your involvement is going to make the difference between whether this probably works or not. And you're going to get to travel to Europe. And I said, absolutely. Where do I sign up? And that was around 2003. And this was my involvement in Mars Express. And so I helped the European Space Agency get the mission to Mars, but, you know, it's clearly about ESA and not about, you know, the JPL people that were able to help out. And that's like one of my, because I never thought in a million years somebody like me would even get to go to Europe.
Thank you. Such an incredible story.
And so that was awesome.
Dear listeners, thank you so much for sticking with us. As always, if you have any questions, please do not hesitate getting in contact with me. My email is podcast@spacewatch.global. If you want to find out more about Moriba Jha's fascinating work, please do go to the website Space Watch Global, and you'll find all the information you have ever dreamt of. And by the way, if you would like to share something with us, if you do have a bunch of interesting space stories to share or have questions, please get in touch. Moriba, thank you so much for taking the time. That was really a pleasure. And hey, you know what? Scientists are people just like you and me. And science is cool. And there's no borders towards becoming a scientist, right?
If there's a scientist inside of everybody.
Thank you so much, Moriba. Have a great day.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.